Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Glenn and Helen Show. Our topic today is marriage and divorce for men. And we've got family lawyer Lauren Strange Boston in the studio.
I've noticed there are a lot of books and resources for women on divorce, but there's not so many for men. And from the comments on my blog, it seems like this is a topic that's important to men. And Lauren's going to help us today with good advice for pre-marriage, marriage, and divorce. Though if you're lucky, you'll manage to avoid stage three.
We've got Lauren in the studio now. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, I think we need to get out some wine for this one. What do you think, Glenn?
Absolutely.
Hey, sounds good to me.
Yeah, this is a topic that's very difficult for people. Why don't you start off, Lauren, by telling us a little bit about your law practice and how you got interested in this line of work?
My practice consists mostly of family law, and that is divorce and custody and lots of post-divorce cases. I do other civil litigation, but the vast majority of it is domestic relations. Your question about how did I get interested in this line of work, this may not be the answer you were looking for, but I was remarkably not interested in doing this kind of work.
I don't think anybody's interested in doing divorce work.
I had been through a fair amount of domestic litigation in my own life with my own children, and I felt like I'd spent a good portion of my life already doing that, and, you know, I've raised my girls, and it all turned out all right, but it was not a fun experience. And the one thing I did not ever want to do when I went to law school, which was a second career for me, by the way, was to ever walk into another courtroom that was family law oriented. But those 3 years come and go, and you got a lot of debt after law school, and the phone call I got was for somebody who wanted me to do domestic relations. And lo and behold, I ended up in that field and found that I think a lot of my personal experience has really helped me help other people with that.
Really? That sounds like what psychologists go through. A lot of us, we decide that we have a lot of problems and maybe can learn a little bit about ourselves in the process and use that to help other people.
But they choose it, and I backed into it simply because of that situation. In law school, I studied all corporate law and all business things and never intended to do this, but I do feel like this is my niche, so I'm glad I'm doing it.
Well, lots of surveys show that half of marriages end in divorce, and people get divorced when marriages go bad, and then they usually wish that things had gone differently, that they'd done things differently up front. What are some mistakes that people make in terms of marriage, in terms of getting married or in terms of being married, that you see a lot in your practice leading to divorce later?
Well, Glenn, I certainly do not profess to be an expert on the pre-marriage or the the marriage process and how to make it work. A lot of people apparently are not experts at that because we have a really high divorce rate, which is an unfortunate thing. From what I've observed, from my own experience, from what I've read, I would say probably the biggest problem in entering a marriage and then being able to stay in a marriage is that people have unrealistic expectations. They somehow think that one person is going to fill every single niche in their life for companionship and fun and, you know, just activity and recreation.
Do you see that with both men and women?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe more so with women, frankly.
Okay.
Women have more unrealistic expectations than men do.
What kinds of expectations do they have of men?
I think women tend to grow up with fairy tales about a Prince Charming. And little girls are raised to, I don't know, even anticipate what it's going to be like to be a bride. When I recall, now that you ask this, what on Halloween, when I was 6 years old, my costume was a bride costume. And I know my parents still have it because I ran across it at some point. You don't see little boys looking forward towards their wedding. And I think that, on one hand, it's romantic and it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's just that sometimes I think women pin too much on it and then get really frustrated because their husbands can't read their minds. If you really loved me, you would know what I needed or know what I wanted.
What is this whole thing where women think that people can read their minds? What's that about?
If you loved me, you would know what I needed and I wouldn't have to tell you. Well, I don't think that's realistic. And I also think that you know, what women need might be different from what men need. Now, I am not a psychologist and I'm certainly not professing to offer expert advice here. This is simply my observations from all the people who end up in my office who are in a very disappointed stage of their lives.
And the men, what are they disappointed about? What do you think they needed?
I think what I see most in the men is that they never, quite a few of them, never really figured out that there was anything going wrong.
Okay.
You know,
so
and
it comes out of the blue.
Right. And that, and maybe it's as if, well, not so much that it comes out of the blue, because generally I think their wives are letting them know in not necessarily subtle ways that they are not happy. Mm-hmm. You know, that things aren't really going all that well. But I just think men and women sometimes look at things differently and perceive things differently. And a situation that might be perfectly acceptable and fine and cruising along just great for a guy is leaving the woman feeling sort of empty and lonely and not communicated with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the same token, sometimes that can get just too heavy for some guys. Now, that's a stereotype, and I will tell you that I represent a whole lot of men, and I'm seeing more and more that that's almost, sometimes that's shoes on the other foot.
Right.
That the guy really has this idealistic view of marriage, and he really wants that kind of closeness and that kind of regular communication and absolute devotion to the kids, and can't really understand why mom's not really all on board with that. So I don't know. Society's changing so much. I don't know that the stereotypes really apply like they did even 10 years ago.
Jeez, if you can't even count on a stereotype,
I know. I mean, what can you count on if you just can't put it in a box and stop thinking about it? But I guess every situation is individual, and you just the idea to sign up for life with somebody who's not your absolute best buddy sounds like a mistake to me.
And but again, you're putting this sort of realistic, unrealistic sort of expectations on things. I mean, if somebody has to be your absolute best buddy in the whole world and meet every
not
need,
meet every need,
okay.
But just when it comes down to loyalty,
right.
When it comes down
to
when push comes to shove, you know, the earth starts shaking if you live in San Francisco, or the warnings come on the TV. Who is that person you are going to go to and stand by? The one person to whom you feel that ultimate loyalty, that's the person you should marry. And if you don't feel that way, maybe...
But why do so many people, men and women, I mean, I see men all the time, they'll go after these women, and you're like, oh my gosh, what are you doing?
What are you
I mean,
doing?
I talk to men, you know, a lot in my practice, you know, in everyday life, and you do really kind of wonder if a person doesn't, you know, so a man would want to look for a woman who is loyal, so that might be a quality.
But he needs to be
loyal
equally
himself.
As loyal.
Yes.
Another thing that probably would have been a better answer to your prior question, because I see this day in and day out. People seem to marry someone who resonates with them on something less than a conscious level. If they grew up in a situation where, say, one of their parents, let's say their father, was an alcoholic, or he was unavailable, emotionally unavailable for some reason. I mean, he was there. Obviously, they spent holidays together. The parents never got divorced, but for whatever reason, he was somewhat emotionally unavailable. By golly. No matter how much therapy
right.
that person goes through, and it's not just a woman. I just used if your father was that way, then I was referring to a woman, but it is exactly the same thing with the men with whom I meet. If there is something, I guess, subliminal in there that tells you, by golly, I'm going to conquer this.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to feel the love that I should have felt then. And then they go out and they marry someone who, on some subliminal level, just clicks in with them.
With their pathology,
Exactly. People who grow up with alcoholic parents hate alcoholism. Hate it. Vow they're never going to be involved with it. And everyone I have met has either become one or married one. Now, what are the odds of that? If you didn't grow up with an alcoholic, I didn't grow up with an alcoholic, I don't think I've ever, or certainly not to my knowledge, mm-hmm. in all my life, even had a date with an alcoholic. Now, if I did, the person didn't interest me, and so it never went beyond a first or second date, so I never found out they were an alcoholic. So how is that? People who grow up in a house where there's domestic violence, mm-hmm. somebody is clobbering somebody or just abusing somebody, those children hate that worse than anything. Invariably, they grow up and they either hook up with a spouse who somehow, after the blush is off, abuses them, or they become an abuser, or lo and behold, they visit it out on the kids.
Of course, that's the ones you see, right?
Well, nobody's having a really good day when they come to my office. I mean, you know, I'm having a great day. I think I'll go see a divorce lawyer. But the truth is, these are the kinds of problems.
So one of the things people might do is, I mean, you think that therapy, I mean, prior to getting married, you might want to really do some introspective work and look into, you know, why am I marrying this person, or what is it that I like about that person, or what can I do, you know, sort of think about some of these things before that. And, you know, the thing that gets me is that a lot of times, you know, you'll have a friend or somebody you know, and you'll see them marrying the completely wrong person.
That's
are
you thinking?
Yeah, but you never want to say anything because you know they won't listen. So, you know, that's sort of a quandary, too. But I think the best thing is to sort of know yourself and know what your hot spots are.
Well,
and
we also noticed it's much easier to sit with someone else and to see the entire picture mm-hmm. and realize that they're getting themselves into something that cannot possibly work. Then you turn the vision inward and you're just too close to yourself. And some of the people, you know, that probably includes all of us, but certainly lots of the people with whom I meet, I mean, they're therapists to their friends. I mean, they mm-hmm. really understand these concepts. But when they look at themselves, they just don't recognize those patterns. You were talking about picking a spouse. Our culture is all about, you know, love songs. Like, if I don't have you in my life, I'll die. And, you know, all of this kind mm-hmm. of stuff. A little unhealthy, but that's sort of the way, that's sort of our version of romance. And one of the things I sort of laugh about a lot with clients, once we've gotten to the laughing stage and perhaps a little past the crying stage, is we sort of define love as this, oh my gosh, heart beating out of my chest. Look into your eyes. I feel like I've known you all my life. Being with you feels like coming home. You just know right away that's the person you're going to marry. And people ultimately do come home. So you better think long and hard about what home was. Because you are, in fact, going home. And I just think that when you grow up in a situation where there's a big emotional boo-boo, there was just something missing, it just kind of puts a little chip in your brain. And how do those women who grew up with alcoholic parents find alcoholics to date? When those of us who did not grow up with alcoholic parents never even bump into one, how do they do that? They've got that little receiver in their brain.
And what would be the receiver for men?
Them out. Same thing. I'm just talking about people who grew up with
alcoholic
parents.
I want a girl just like the girl that married dear old dad.
Exactly.
Right?
And even though you may, on the surface and intellectually, think that's the last thing I want, if when you were in your formative years, that's where you got derailed because that's where you weren't getting what you were needing, you still want mommy to love you. You still want daddy to love you. That is such an inbred genetic, I think, need for people, that they just spend the rest of their lives working on it. And somehow they've got these great receptors for picking out people who are emotionally unavailable or maybe have a substance abuse problem or on the surface seem great, but a couple of months from now when things head south on them, this person's going to get violent. I don't know how they know that, but they know it 100% of the time.
Well, I see those people every day.
you're a therapist and I'm not. I'm just telling you my observations,
right.
Or that the statistics are unbelievable.
You see it in a different angle. Don't they have these studies that show your friends are better at picking for you than you are?
Yeah, the family and the friends.
And, you know, I had one friend who got married, and pretty much all of us thought it was a bad marriage, and we sort of tried to talk to him about it. Of course, he wasn't listening to any of it.
Sure.
And then after he got divorced, he had the, chutzpah to come back and say, why didn't you tell me?
Well,
we
actually,
did.
I made notes.
Yeah,
here, let me look in this drawer.
Here's the affidavit you signed of not doing me. You know,
that you would not listen to me, right. Even though I've given you this
advice. But really, you know, that might be one piece of advice you might want to give people is, you know, see how your friends feel about it. I mean, you can't let your friends make decisions for you, but they do have a different perspective.
And if they are your real friends and they really know you, they might know you're vulnerable in one area or another area, that there's some area in your life that maybe you just feel a little bit less than, and maybe you're fixing that a little bit by hooking up with this person. And if they're your real friends, they love you anyway. I mean, they're not expecting perfection from you. That's part of your charm, but they might go, you know, might you be feeling so drawn to this person because if you can just get that one, who happens to be exactly like Daddy, to love you, then you fixed it. And I tell you, I see it every single day.
So some advice would be listen to your friends and maybe talk to them prior to getting married a little bit and just feel them out, get some feedback.
Or look at yourself, get alone, and look at the worst emotional boo-boos you've ever had. If there was something that could almost, if you thought too much about it, really carry you to a sad space or a scared space or a worried space, try to think about that, which most people, quite frankly, that's not good advice because nobody's going to do it. Nobody is going to look under rocks that make them miserable, or very few people do. The ones who are willing to come to your office and they get therapy or whatever, but you know, that's a very hard thing to do. But
it may keep you from ending up in your office.
Yeah, make sure you're not picking someone else who's emotionally unavailable, right. Because by golly, this is the one who you're going to get to love you. Maybe you can avoid some stuff like that because you're not going to change that person. He or she is who he or she is and has every right to be. And they're not here to fix your boo-boos.
So before we move completely beyond the pre-marriage thing, let me ask you, do you see very many clients who've had a prenuptial agreement or are people just dead set against those?
I've written some, I've seen some clients who have had some, and I've actually litigated the enforceability of some. Not a whole lot. Prenuptial agreements seem, or they're also called antenuptial agreements, which is, sounds very confusing to people. Mm-hmm. Ante, you think of as post, but they're both a prenup. That's the kind of thing that seems to be very accepted and kind of appropriate in a situation where maybe people are getting married in their 60s or in their 70s. And that, I think, is just the sweetest, most wonderful thing. You can find love, you can find romance in your 90s if you want to. But those people have already earned their money and they do have children or perhaps grandchildren for whom they want to provide. And so does the person who they're marrying. And so that person might want to have some arrangements that say, look, you know, my kids have been in my family for 50 or 60 years. You've been in my family for 1 year, and you know, I may be dead before you're in my family 10 years. I want to leave my arrangements as they are. That's a real good basis for a prenup. You also see them in situations where one person is dramatically more wealthy than the other person is. Personally, you know, I've kind of got mixed emotions about them. I see why people would want to do them, certainly in that situation where there's an inequity in the financial status. Also, divorce is so prevalent now, a lot of people who have money are getting married for the second time. And, you know, she got the mine and he got the shaft or something. But they don't want to go through that again, so they're just trying to prepare, and I don't think it's a bad business move. The romantic side of me, and this is purely personal, this is not advice I would give anybody, it's just what I think, is that, you know, maybe if you're going to marry somebody and you're going to stand up in front of God and the community and everybody and you are going to vow to spend the rest of your lives together, maybe you don't need to carve a back door. Maybe in a way that almost sets you up to think that there's a way out. And I think there's so much divorce now because it is always a way out. It's so easy to get out. Nothing is cheap, but it's easy.
What are some of the big misconceptions you find most people have about the legal aspects of divorce?
People who have not experienced it, either firsthand or certainly through someone very close to them, a sibling, a parent, a child, what have you, watch too much TV, and they derive their impressions of it from maybe L.A. Law or something like that. And they decide that the other person has wronged me. I shall be vindicated. I am going to go into court, and my lawyer, the bulldog lady, is going to present my case, and the judge is going to point his finger or her finger at my spouse and say, "You are a lousy, rotten person. You are a good person. Yay, you win." Not going to happen. It is not going to happen. The judges have seen a billion cases before yours. They understand that and such a small percentage of the cases, it's almost not worth mentioning, do two people get here because of the actions of only one of them. We're human beings. You know, in Tennessee, we have inappropriate marital conduct. What does that mean? You squeeze the toothpaste from the top? I mean, I don't know. Obviously, that would not be grounds to get you a divorce, but truly, do you know a married person who hasn't been guilty of inappropriate marital conduct? Just being, don't look at her like that now.
She feels the covers.
Yeah, I now see, and a lot of
that
qualifies. You know, a lot of that just sort of, it depends on how it is you decide you're going to handle your spouse's really rotten days, because he or she's going to have them. But it just, people just think that they're going to be vindicated, that the judge is going to see it my way as long as I have a good lawyer, and I'm going to come out the good guy. And even if the judge really does see it that way, and as an attorney, oh, I long for it. I like the good guy to win. I mean, it's wonderful when once in a blue moon you hear the judge go, "You know what? What is wrong with you?" You know, looking at the other person, at the other party. But it almost never happens. They find a way to compromise. Most of the time, both litigants walk out at least a little dissatisfied. One is usually a lot more dissatisfied than the other. I mean, someone does tend to win and someone does tend to lose. But in domestic relations, we're dividing marital property. And so it's not so much a win-lose. It's, you might feel like you lost because you didn't get the sofa, or you didn't get more than 50% of the IRA, but everything's going to be divvied up to some degree, so it's not a slam dunk necessarily. Custody is a little different. If both parties are fighting for primary residential custody of the children, and they are actively seeking that role in a courtroom, then somebody is going to walk out, I guess, and feeling like a loser. But that person might very well walk out with more co-parenting time, mm-hmm, than the other person wanted them to have. And so even though that person won, so to speak, they're not entirely happy either, because they haven't managed to cut the other person out of their lives, which is sort of the mood you get in when you're in a divorce.
So it can be lose-lose.
It generally is lose-lose. Divorce is lose-lose. It is lose-lose. It's not just lose-lose between the husband and wife. It's lose-lose-lose if there are children involved. Because it is the demise of something that was built to be good. If you have a really elderly grandparent who's suffering, and that person dies, you're going to grieve. It doesn't mean it wasn't for the best, but you're going to grieve. It's a sad and it's a hard time. It's an adjustment time. You've got the same amount of money supporting two households now that used to support one. That is a tangible difference in everybody's life. You've got children who now have to eat two full-blown Thanksgiving dinners. Ever try to do that? It's
me,
not easy.
Three.
You all eat three. Okay, well, so, you know, but that's an entirely different problem. You know, but it's hard on the kids. It's hard on the parents. Now, that being said, I'm not saying that you should avoid divorce at all costs. If the relationship is no longer serving you, if you cannot be who you really know in your heart you want to be and live the way you want to and live according to, you know, the values that you have because the environment in your household is so compromised by the other person, or perhaps the way that other person treats the kids or feels about the kids or treats you. And I'm just talking about generic situations. I'm not talking about obvious things where someone is just blatantly committing adultery. I don't think anybody would expect someone to stay with that. Or someone is blatantly physically or verbally abusing the other person, or
do you see men
like
in
that.
Those situations who are being abused? Is there a domestic abuse of men?
You know, there is.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm not saying it wasn't always there.
Mm-hmm.
It there may have been less of it there, say, 50, 60, 70 years ago, when women's role in society was entirely different. And they, you know, women could only vote, what, at the early part of the last century. I mean, you know, people are still alive.
Well, what's interesting is women used to kill their husbands more readily in the 70s, and even before, there were many more killings of men.
Really?
Yes.
You know, that's funny. I've not heard that, but it doesn't surprise me, because what is the old saying? If you're going to attack the king, you had better kill him. Because if he survives, you've got a tremendous problem on your hands. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way society was structured prior to that,
but
probably women felt the same way. The only way out was to make him go away, because if he continued to exist, the way our power structure was set up, then
is that how men feel now? Do you think that's why there are more men who now kill women? Maybe they feel like they can't get out of it. Maybe there's a power struggle now with them.
I don't know, but that doesn't sound right to me.
Well, what do you see with the men in terms of abuse and such? You started to say you see a lot of it.
Well, you know, it sort of seems unusual. Now, it's not unusual to me anymore, because I've seen quite a bit of it. And I will say that, certainly from my observation, it is still far more. Are you talking about physical abuse? If you're talking about physical abuse or verbal abuse that is so heinous that it comes really close to that,
mm-hmm.
I would say that there's still a lot more of that coming from men to women, because, you know, I think we're chemically different. You know, men are raised more Rambo-like. They have more testosterone. And when it comes to the physical sort of reaction to discord, you still see the bigger, you know, you still see more of it men on women. But I will tell you, I don't know if it's because, as we started to talk about a few minutes ago but then got derailed, if it's that society has changed, or if it's just that people talk about it more now.
And I'm wondering if the men would tell you.
I will
you if they
tell
were
you,
abused.
I have had cases, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying where I've just represented the man who was the victim. I've represented many women who came in and just said, you know, he just made me so mad. They are picking up things, and I'm talking heavy objects that could hurt or kill a person, and heaving them. They are hitting, they're slugging, they're in his face. And it's a frustration level. It's the same thing as road rage, I guess. It's just a failure to manage the stresses of everyday life, and quite honestly, to act like an adult. Because we all make choices, and we all get mad enough to just punch somebody's lights out. But not punching someone's lights out is the appropriate decision. I mean, unless it's truly self-defense and somebody's trying to kill you. There's just no excuse to go punching your spouse. And people do it all the time. And that's immaturity. It's self-indulgence. It's frustration boiling over. Now, this is just my opinion. That is simply not justified.
Okay,
the marriage goes down the tubes and you're looking at divorce. What should you do to prepare?
I hesitate to say this because it's going to sound really hokey, but what you should do to prepare, whether you're the man or the woman, is you should focus a little less on winning and a lot more on doing the right thing. If you can take the high road, take the high road. Don't run to everyone in town and make sure you get to the friends at church, to the friends at the pool, to the people who live next door, to your spouse's family first. Oh, you're knitting your brow, Helen. Oh.
I know, I'm just like...
Just have no idea what people do.
No,
I know. What they do is suddenly
day.
We go from... You know, in a lot of marriages that break up, there's been this lovely facade.
Mm-hmm.
People always think I'm going to be shocked when they come in and say, everyone thinks we're the perfect couple. Everybody thinks everybody's the perfect couple unless they're getting written up in the paper. Most people, unless they're really sort of over the edge, are not airing their dirty laundry in public. They may scream at each other all the way home from a party, but you've got to have way too much to drink to start screaming at your spouse at the party. But it happens all the time. And so, you know, and sometimes I think people just sort of have a vested interest in other people's marriages working out. You're my friend. You're my friend. I don't want to deal with being upset that y'all are getting divorced. So I don't want to know that. I want you together. Same with your family members. Because I've got my own life to think about. Don't make me worry about your life. And that doesn't mean I don't care for you. I'm just saying that people seem to have a vested interest in keeping the people in their lives kind of where they feel they belong. And so that often happens. Everyone thinks we have the perfect marriage.
You want a lawyer. What do you do? How do you find a good lawyer? You ask around for the bulldog?
That would be good. Oh, you were saying, what do we do to prepare for a divorce?
Yeah.
That's one of the things I wanted to tell you. Just don't run around and do that. Take the high road. Don't disparage your spouse to his or her family, to the neighbors, to people at church, and most of all, to those children. Don't do it. Now, you say what you need to say to your spouse behind closed doors. Go find a clergy member to talk to if that's where you feel comfortable. Go find a therapist. You certainly have the right to pour your heart out to your best friend or your family.
You're a man,
but don't be bashing
them. Say you're
a
man and you've got a job, you're making money, and you're worried about this woman who's going to take you to the cleaners. What do you do?
Again, you focus on doing the right thing, which means what do these children need?
Letting her take you to the cleaners? Okay.
That's not necessarily doing the right thing at all. You look at these children. And, you know, it also depends on what your issues are. Now, in some marriages, it's very clear to both parties, before anybody shows up in my office, that one parent has been the primary caregiver. And really, logistically speaking, needs to remain the primary caregiver. And that's simply for the comfort and convenience of the children. One of the things that I would advise not just guys, but women to do as well, because we're seeing a whole lot more fathers having custody. Mm-hmm. That's becoming more acceptable, and so, you know, women are maybe letting that happen when they feel it's best as well. Men are thinking it's okay to go for that when they think that it's best. But if by the time I get the case, if that issue is already resolved, the parties already know what's best for the kids, then just keep doing what you're doing. Because if you can agree before you ever get to a divorce lawyer on what living setup is best for your children, you're already doing really, really well. Keep parenting your kids, keep loving your kids, and do not disparage your spouse to the kids. Now, if that issue has not been resolved, if both spouses feel that they are truly the more appropriate person to be the children's primary residential caregiver or parent, well, then, those are the really tough cases. Those are the very expensive cases. People will litigate way beyond their ability to pay for it when it comes to their kids. And so, you know, what do you do to prepare for that?
Make them pay cash up front?
Well, there's that. You know, there's certainly some cash paid up front. You can never pay for an entire divorce case up front. I don't know of any lawyer who requires that. Plus, you don't know how much it's going to cost, because it really depends on the fight you get from the other side. But in preparing yourself, I would say, if you have been trying to avoid conflict in the house that's maybe happening on a regular basis because you and your spouse are fighting all the time, and you know, you all both know that you're headed for divorce, it's not a smart idea to avoid conflict by going out in the evenings. You know, my spouse works all day. I'm home. I take care of the kids all day. Or, you know, I get home at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So the kids are at daycare at school for the first maybe third of the day. And then I take care of them the second third of the day. And then when he gets home, I split because it's so miserable being here and I can't stand it. So I'm out running around with my girlfriends or whatever it is you're doing. Because you're just making it really easy for your spouse to go in and say, either I do the dinner or certainly clean up after the dinner if the children, if it's age appropriate. Kids help me with that. I do the bath. I do the bedtime. I make sure the homework's done. You know, when Johnny wakes up in the night with a bad dream and cries, he cries for me because mommy goes out at night. Bad move. Stay home and deal with it. You don't have to be immersed in a fight all the time. It takes two to fight. If somebody is going to stand there and yell at you and do all these crazy things when you're not saying anything back, I mean, how long do you think that's going to go on? Not very long. It escalates because you play into it.
So it could hurt you. I mean, it could really hurt you.
Yes, it could really hurt you. Let me tell you what else can hurt you. Adultery can hurt you. Adultery is a no-no. I think that's obvious. Probably it's less of a no-no in terms of how it can hurt your lawsuit than it used to be. It's just that I think what it signals to the court, because the judge is a human being, is that your priorities are elsewhere. Number one, you know, what people are really doing when they're in an affair is really focusing on that other person. It's that sort of taboo, forbidden thing. Their mind's not on their children. I mean, people can say it is, but it isn't. And nobody's going to believe that. So that's number one. Number two, it's bad judgment. The court is looking for somebody in this family to park these children with who makes decisions based on a rational thought process. If you don't want to be married anymore, that's okay. If you've sort of bumped into somebody and there's chemistry and you think you'd like to pursue it, that is human nature. Put it on hold. Put it on a back burner and go home and deal with your marriage. And if it's not going to work, then get out of it. You know, you don't have to go through necessarily 2 years of divorce, but at least get out of the house so that it doesn't,
separate. Okay.
Separate.
So get a legal separation.
And well, no, a legal separation is a different beast.
Okay.
You don't have to do that. There is legal separation in Tennessee, but it's the same thing as divorce, except it's not divorce. In other words, we are legally separated. We have a parenting plan. We have decided how the money's going to flow back and forth. We may have even divvied up the stuff, but we're just not getting a divorce. Well, why do that?
That's like the old, what was it, divorce from bed and board under the common law or something?
Yeah, that is what that was. Yeah. And several years ago, they actually made a statute, and it's called a legal separation. But the problem that I find with it, and like I said, I do almost all divorce and tons of it. I think I've seen two. I mean, why do it? Just go ahead. If you think the marriage is going to fall apart, if you think it's going to end and you want to separate, then just file a complaint for divorce. You don't have to do anything about it. And it preserves everything. And then if you end up able to reconcile with your spouse, well, then you can just withdraw it. But I'm not saying you can't get a legal separation. I'm just saying that if you end up in divorce, it's just a lot of extra paperwork.
Do you think that men are disfavored in disputes over child custody or child support? Or do you think that's changed?
Well, child custody and child support are really different issues, certainly in Tennessee anyway, and really in most states now, because child support is just, it's arithmetic. It is taken off a chart. There are a lot of things that are factored in that make the math problem maybe a little more algebraic than just arithmetic, but it's still just a math function. The custody thing, if men are disadvantaged at this point, I will tell you it is a whole lot less than they used to be. Every court I practice in, and I don't just practice in the county in which I live, I practice in lots of surrounding counties and in front of quite a few different judges. They're used to seeing dads care for the kids these days. In the past, if a man came in and said, well, I'm really the one doing everything, maybe the judge would wonder, well, that sounds good, but I wonder how true that really is. But now, women work outside the home every bit as many hours a week as men do, sometimes more. There are only so many waking hours in a day. And if you're all convening at the house for the first time at 6 p.m., then I can tell you there is a division of labor, because how else could you get it done?
So what percentage of men are actually being awarded custody in your cases? Of the men who want custody, what percentage would you say get custody?
in my practice, Helen, I think that any statistics I could give you might be misrepresentative of the area as a whole, only because of the way that I handle my clients. When a client comes to me, whether it that client is a woman or a man, I'm very, very straightforward with them about what it is they're really doing and what their motives really are, and just how capable the court is going to be of seeing right through what they're doing if it is not based on the truth. Personally, as an attorney, I have no desire to go into court and argue for something that is bogus and ridiculous.
Are you saying men wanting custody of the children?
No, even if a woman does. I'm saying it's exactly the same. If a man really wants custody and fights for custody, and I'm representing him, I would say the vast majority of the men whom I represent get custody. But that's because of the way I do it. I'm going to talk them out of it if I don't think they're going to win.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, that's why I'm saying I don't think any number I could give
you. Right, because you only take the ones that you think are going to be able to.
It's not that I only take those. It's that I work with people so much to really look at their own situation and to be honest with their own vulnerability, certainly in terms of the lawsuit, that they get it by the time they're, you know. What I'm pointing out to them is really obvious if they'll just sort of look in the mirror and see what's going on. And they usually come to the conclusion that maybe it's not best to arrange it that way. But what I do think is best, that we do a very different co-parenting arrangement in terms of time sharing. And then, you know, maybe we can move from there. But I have to tell you, the idea of going into court and just spending all of that time and staking my own reputation, not to mention burning through this guy's money or this woman's money to fight for something that I don't think they have a snowball's chance of winning. And number two, that doesn't feel right because they shouldn't win it because they're not doing what's right for the kids and anybody can see it. I don't want to do that. I've got to go into that courtroom for the rest of my life. I don't want to be associated with that. So, yeah, the guys that come to me and really want custody and end up going to court for custody, they generally get it.
What do you do if you get to, if your soon-to-be ex makes a bogus charge of abuse or molestation or domestic violence? And I know you see that sort of thing. What should somebody do about that?
Well, I see it so much that it is awful. It's just awful.
I have to say, I'm sort of the point where if the first time I hear something like that is in the context of a divorce, I just sort of assume it's bogus.
Well, that's a valid viewpoint, and I will tell you that some people who are really going for broke go and file criminal charges against the person as well. So they go on the civil side to get an order of protection, which is what it's called here, but every state's got them, protective orders or whatever they're called in other areas. But you can also go to the DA and swear out a warrant and do that. Now, one thing to bear in mind, Glenn, is that by the time people are really in a divorce, the emotions are so high that you really can't see domestic violence for the very first time. And so you don't want to poo-poo it. You really need to listen to it. I do see lots and lots of situations where people make those kinds of allegations or at least really exaggerate what happened simply in order to get an advantage in the divorce. For example, it's not a real pleasant situation to live in the same house with someone who is your legal adversary and fighting you over your children, whether you're the man or the woman. That's not fun. I don't know if y'all saw the movie The War of the Roses, but, you know, it's really not fun to continue to live with someone with whom you're going through a divorce. So, but if your house is that person's house as well, which it is if it's the marital residence, he or she has every bit as much right to live there as you do. This is America. I mean, they can't just strip you of your property rights because your spouse no longer likes the way you look. And so how do you get them out of there? Well, if you can go in and allege violence, then maybe that's an advantage. I hate to even say this on the show because I certainly don't want to encourage anybody to do that. Your question, Glenn, was what do you do if someone has made that bogus allegation? You simply deny it. You hire an attorney. You give them every detail you can, and you hope that your attorney has some great vision or inspiration, because how do you prove you didn't say something?
Right.
Does this happen more often to women or to men?
I think it happens more often to men. I think more often women make an allegation of domestic violence against men only because the traditional conception is that men are the perpetrators of domestic violence, and they tend to be bigger anyway. And it's just a lot easier for people to accept that maybe the big male person in the relationship lost his cool.
But do you think the judge believes this? Are they up to date? Because I see a lot of professionals who don't understand this. They truly believe they see men as perpetrators and women as victims. And I, in my practice and my work, I oftentimes see the opposite.
Well, you get the abused men.
I get a lot of abused men.
I get abused men as well. Mm-hmm. And I also think there are a whole lot of ways to abuse a human being without ever using physical violence.
That's true.
And women are very good at that. Now, I'll say that women are very good at that.
But now, they don't call that abuse if it's against a man?
Well, it's not the kind of abuse that warrants you an order of protection. It's not an assault. In Tennessee, an order of protection is you have to harm the person or their property or their, you know, the kids or whatever, or you have to put them in a realistic fear of doing that. You have to threaten to harm them. You know, people say in a kidding tone sometimes to their friends, oh, I could just kill you for doing that. Well, don't say it if your spouse is looking for a way to get you out of the house. Okay? There's your free legal advice. But I mean, when people get really angry at one another, you know, they just say things like, you know, if you get near me, I'm going to, or I could just choke you. And some of those people really mean, I could choke you. And it is a threat. But if you say something like that, whether it was really a serious threat or not,
but are you saying
that he's going to buy it?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. But if you're a woman, in other words, if you're a woman and you say it, that might be okay because you might not be seen as a perpetrator. Is that? Or do they see it both ways?
I think they see it both ways.
Okay.
The courts that are very prone to grant orders of protection are simply going to listen to the evidence, and if it passes the smell test, you know, might very well grant the order of protection. There are other courts, and when I say courts, the court is the judge. It is the person. So that person might be less inclined to get all worked up over something that somebody said, and not grant the order of protection. So, you know, it really depends on what court you're in, and it depends on what happens. But, yes, there are false allegations
all the time. You were talking before about men and women. How do they differ in the way they deal with the legal system in divorce? I mean, what kind of personality traits do they have that might help or hurt their case? For example, you were talking about the way women might behave or
right,
when men might behave.
Well, the way that I see men behave that doesn't necessarily serve them in the litigation process isn't a bad thing. I'm going to preface this by saying it's not a bad thing. It's not even, depending on the person, an unattractive thing. It just doesn't get you where you need to go. As we were talking about a little while ago, I think boys are raised differently. You know, I think we're all sort of chemically geared differently anyway, possibly from birth, but that's a whole nother podcast or whatever this is. Boys are more likely to solve a dispute or an affront on the kickball field by punching him in the nose or, you know, whatever it is that they're going to do. And because of the role I think that men have traditionally played in society, it's a more openly aggressive role. And I don't mean aggressive in the negative sense in the word. In fact, aggressive isn't a negative word. When it's used to describe men, it tends to be when it's used to describe women, which is yet again another topic. But guys want to fight back. When someone does something that's unfair, pulls a fast one in the litigation, tricks them out of, you know, some time they should have had with their children or some extra money, guys want to go in there and just do something about it. And I think that is perfectly justified. Wow. One of the things I have to work with my guys about a lot, though, is that let's just be patient. Let's be patient. The judge is going to tire of us very quickly if we run in with every grievance. Let's try to work it out. Let's work with the other side. Let's leave a paper trail about making non-litigious attempts to resolve it. Because if we do, then by the time we go in, the judge is going to be more irritated than you are, and we're going to win. And that is incredibly effective. Guys don't want to hear it at first, but once they work on it, they're great at it. And so I don't say that as a detriment to guys. I'm just saying that desire to just immediately fight back and run into court and vanquish the other side, that's not a very savvy way to do a lawsuit.
What do women do wrong?
Women, what do you think is just a personality trait? Sometimes you can just, nothing quite that stands out as clearly to me is that sometimes I think women can be really manipulative. They can buy very much into the role of being a victim.
Mm-hmm.
And not recognize how unattractive that is. And
does it work for them in a court of law?
Not for very long.
Okay.
For one thing, you all just know people, and certainly you in your practice, who are just always the victim. It's mm-hmm. gross. I mean, people just get it right away and don't want to be around it. And judges are people. And judges are smart people, and they've done lots and lots and lots of these cases, and they're going to figure you out.
Why do so many men say they get the chef? Why have so many men said they've been treated unfairly by the court systems? I mean, you see that all the time, and you actually see it. I mean, you yourself said that men are getting charged with molestation, charged with abuse, all kinds of things. If judges were that smart, why haven't they figured out how to make things equal for men?
Well, I think that the order of protection scenario is completely different from all the other things we're talking about. All right? When you're talking about domestic violence, and let me tell you, this is not much of a problem except, you know, in fits and starts. There are some judges who are more prone to give these things. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Just judges have their own personalities. But I think most judges would rather err on the side of caution if they think somebody's really going to get hurt. And I think we would all agree with that. It's just some people are more inclined to think somebody's going to get hurt than somebody else's. That's a judge personality thing. On everything else, do I see men being treated unfairly in court? I've got to tell you, Helen, I really don't. I really don't. Now, I mean, not any more than I see women being treated unfairly in court, simply because, you know, that judge just didn't like you, or there was something about the way you handled yourself that made a bigger wrong impression than was really warranted. But when it comes to custody and division of property and the flow of money from one party to the other, I have to tell you that I really don't see men being treated unfairly, or women.
Okay, final stage. What about dealing with your ex after a divorce? Any advice?
Oh, goodness.
Because you're going to, right? People think they're going to get a divorce to get this person out of their life. And then they discover, you know, especially, at least if they have kids, that, hey, they're still around.
Well, I will tell you, Glenn, that at least a third of my practice is post-divorce work. So that ought to tell you something. We've already been divorced, and now we want to go back at it some more. How to deal with your spouse after a divorce. Try to just ratchet it down. You know, just don't wear everything on your sleeve. Just don't take so much offense. The best revenge is a life well lived. Go forth, prosper, be happy. Find love somewhere else if you can. Enjoy being single if that's what you like to do. You have divorced this person. Just quit doing the dance with them. You've got court orders that spell out what you're supposed to do. If you can agree to contrary things, that's great. If you can't, do what the order says you're supposed to do. Eliminate the reasons to go back and forth with your spouse all the time if you can't do it pleasantly, because your children are going to suffer.
Wow, that seems like a great note to end on, doesn't it?
Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
We hope you stay wedded to these broadcasts in a committed and loving relationship. We'll be back whenever we feel like it. You can check for updates at glennandhelenshow.com or at our blogs, instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com. And you can subscribe via iTunes. We like that. In the meantime, have fun on the internet.
Talk to you next time.